Chapter 22. Warm nourishment made a special repast of mutton chops, which were brought in hot and hot between two plates, and smelt very nice. As it rained after dinner, and they couldn't go out walking on the beach, and Mrs. Pipchin's constitution required rest after chops, they went away with Barry, otherwise Barinthia, to the dungeon, an empty room looking out upon a chalk wall and a water butt, and made ghastly by a ragged fireplace without any stove in it. Enlivened by company, however, this was the best place after all. For Barry played with them there, and seemed to enjoy a game of romps as much as they did, until Mrs. Pipchin knocking angrily at the wall, like the Cock Lane ghost revived, they left off, and Barry told them stories in a whisper until twilight. For tea there was plenty of milk and water, and bread and butter, with a little black teapot for Mrs. Pipchin and Barry, and buttered toast unlimited for Mrs. Pipchin, which was brought in, hot and hot, like the chops. Though Mrs. Pipchin got very greasy, outside, over this dish, it didn't seem to lubricate her internally, at all, for she was as fierce as ever, and the hard gray eye knew no softening. After tea, Barry brought out a little work box, with the royal pavilion on the lid, and fell to working busily, while Mrs. Pipchin, having put on her spectacles, and opened a great volume bound in green baize, began to nod. And whenever Mrs. Pipchin caught herself falling forward into the fire, and woke up, she filliped Master Bitherstone on the nose for nodding too. At last it was the children's bedtime, and after prayers they went to bed. As little Miss Panky was afraid of sleeping alone in the dark, Mrs. Pipchin always made a point of driving her upstairs herself, like a sheep, and it was cheerful to hear Miss Panky moaning long afterwards, in the least eligible chamber, and Mrs. Pipchin now, and then going in to shake her. At about 9:30 the odor of a warm sweet bread, Mrs. Pipchin's constitution wouldn't go to sleep without sweet bread, diversified the prevailing fragrance of the house, which Mrs. Wickham said was a smell of building, apostrophe and slumber fell upon the castle shortly after. The breakfast next morning was like the tea overnight, except that Mrs. Pipchin took her roll instead of toast, and seemed a little more irate when it was over. Master Bitherstone read aloud to the rest a pedigree from Genesis judiciously selected by Mrs. Pipchin, getting over the names with the ease and clearness of a person tumbling up the treadmill. That done, Miss Panky was borne away to be shampooed, and Master Bitherstone to have something else done to him with salt water, from which he always returned very blue and dejected. Paul and Florence went out in the meantime on the beach with Wickham, who was constantly in tears, and at about noon Mrs. Pipchin presided over some early readings. It being a part of Mrs. Pipchin's system, not to encourage a child's mind to develop and expand itself like a young flower, but to open it by force like an oyster, the moral of these lessons was usually of a violent and stunning character. The hero a naughty boy seldom, in the mildest catastrophe, being finished off anything less than a lion, or a bear. Such was life at Mrs. Pipchin's. On Saturday Mr. Dombey came down, and Florence and Paul would go to his hotel, and have tea. They passed the whole of Sunday with him, and generally rode out before dinner, and on these occasions Mr. Dombey seemed to grow, like Falstaff's assailants, and instead of being one man in Buckram, to become a dozen. Sunday evening was the most melancholy evening in the week, for Mrs. Pipchin always made a point of being particularly cross on Sunday nights. Miss Panky was generally brought back from an ancestor at Tingdean, in deep distress, and Master Bitherstone, whose relatives were all in India, and who was required to sit, between the services, in an erect position with his head against the parlor wall, neither moving hand nor foot, suffered so acutely in his young spirits, that he once asked Florence, on a Sunday night, if she could give him any idea of the way back to Bengal. But it was generally said, that Mrs. Pipchin was a woman of system with children, and no doubt she was. Certainly the wild ones went home tame enough, after sojourning for a few months beneath her hospitable roof. It was generally said, too, that it was highly creditable of Mrs. Pipchin to have devoted herself to this way of life, and to have made such a sacrifice of her feelings, and such a resolute stand against her troubles, when Mr. Pipchin broke his heart in the Peruvian mines. At this exemplary old lady, Paul would sit staring in his little armchair by the fire, for any length of time. He never seemed to know what weariness was, when he was looking fixedly at Mrs. Pipchin. He was not fond of her, he was not afraid of her, but in those old moods of his, she seemed to have a grotesque attraction for him. There he would sit, looking at her, and warming his hands, and looking at her, until he sometimes quite confounded Mrs. Pipchin, ogress as she was. Once she asked him, when they were alone, what he was thinking about. "You," apostrophe said Paul, without the least reserve. "And what are you thinking about me?" apostrophe asked Mrs. Pipchin. "I'm thinking how old you must be," apostrophe said Paul. "You mustn't say such things as that, young gentleman," apostrophe returned the dame. "That'll never do." Apostrophe, "Why not?" apostrophe asked Paul. "Because it's not polite," apostrophe said Mrs. Pipchin, snappishly. "Not polite?" apostrophe said Paul. "No." Apostrophe, "It's not polite," apostrophe said Paul, innocently, "to eat all the mutton chops and toast, Wickham says." "Wickham," apostrophe retorted Mrs. Pipchin, coloring, "is a wicked, impudent, bold-faced hussy." Apostrophe, "What's that?" apostrophe inquired Paul. "Never you mind, sir," apostrophe retorted Mrs. Pipchin. "Remember the story of the little boy that was gored to death by a mad bull for asking questions." Apostrophe, "If the bull was mad," apostrophe said Paul, "how did he know that the boy had asked questions? Nobody can go and whisper secrets to a mad bull. I don't believe that story." "You don't believe it, sir?" apostrophe repeated Mrs. Pipchin, amazed. "No," apostrophe said Paul. "Not if it should happen to have been a tame bull, you little infidel?" apostrophe said Mrs. Pipchin. As Paul had not considered the subject in that light, and had founded his conclusions on the alleged lunacy of the bull, he allowed himself to be put down for the present. But he sat turning it over in his mind, with such an obvious intention of fixing Mrs. Pipchin presently, that even that hardy old lady deemed it prudent to retreat until he should have forgotten the subject. From that time, Mrs. Pipchin appeared to have something of the same odd kind of attraction towards Paul, as Paul had towards her. She would make him move his chair to her side of the fire, instead of sitting opposite. And there he would remain in a nook between Mrs. Pipchin and the fender, with all the light of his little face absorbed into the black bombazine drapery, studying every line and wrinkle of her countenance, and peering at the hard gray eye, until Mrs. Pipchin was sometimes fain to shut it, on pretense of dozing. Mrs. Pipchin had an old black cat, who generally lay coiled upon the center foot of the fender, purring egotistically, and winking at the fire until the contracted pupils of his eyes were like two notes of admiration. The good old lady might have been not to record it disrespectfully a witch, and Paul and the cat are two familiars, as they all sat by the fire together. It would have been quite in keeping with the appearance of the party, if they had all sprung up the chimney in a high wind one night, and never been heard of any more. This, however, never came to pass. The cat, and Paul, and Mrs. Pipchin, were constantly to be found in their usual places after dark, and Paul, eschewing the companionship of Master Bitherstone, went on studying Mrs. Pipchin, and the cat, and the fire, night after night, as if they were a book of necromancy, in three volumes. Mrs. Wickham put her own construction on Paul's eccentricities, and being confirmed in her low spirits by a perplexed view of chimneys from the room where she was accustomed to sit, and by the noise of the wind, and by the general dullness, gashliness was Mrs. Wickham's strong expression of her present life, deduced the most dismal reflections from the foregoing premises. It was a part of Mrs. Pipchin's policy to prevent her own young hussy, that was Mrs. Pipchin's generic name for female servant, from communicating with Mrs. Wickham, to which end she devoted much of her time to concealing herself behind doors, and springing out on that devoted maiden whenever she made an approach towards Mrs. Wickham's apartment. But Barry was free to hold what converse she could in that quarter, consistently with the discharge of the multifarious duties at which she toiled incessantly from morning to night, and to Barry Mrs. Wickham unburdened her mind. "What a pretty fellow he is when he's asleep!" said Barry, stopping to look at Paul in bed, one night when she took up Mrs. Wickham's supper. "Ah!" sighed Mrs. Wickham. "He need be. Why, he's not ugly when he's awake," observed Barry. "No, ma'am. Oh, no. No more was my uncle's Betsy Jane," said Mrs. Wickham. Barry looked as if she would like to trace the connection of ideas between Paul Dombey and Mrs. Wickham's uncle's Betsy Jane, "my uncle's wife," Mrs. Wickham went on to say, "died just like his mama. My uncle's child took on just as Master Paul do." Took on. "You don't think he grieves for his mama, sure?" argued Barry, sitting down on the side of the bed. "He can't remember anything about her, you know, Mrs. Wickham. It's not possible." "No, ma'am," said Mrs. Wickham. "No more did my uncle's child. But my uncle's child said very strange things sometimes, and looked very strange, and went on very strange, and was very strange altogether. My uncle's child made people's blood run cold, sometimes, she did."
"How?"
asked Barry. "I wouldn't have sat up all night alone with Betsy Jane," said Mrs. Wickham, "not if you'd have put Wickham into business next morning for himself. I couldn't have done it, Miss Barry." Miss Barry naturally asked why not, but Mrs. Wickham, agreeably to the usage of some ladies in her condition, pursued her own branch of the subject, without any compunction. "Betsy Jane," said Mrs. Wickham, "was as sweet a child as I could wish to see. I couldn't wish to see a sweeter. Everything that a child could have in the way of illnesses, Betsy Jane had come through. The cramps was as common to her," said Mrs. Wickham, "as piles is to yourself, Miss Barry." Miss Barry involuntarily wrinkled her nose. "But Betsy Jane," said Mrs. Wickham, lowering her voice, and looking round the room, and towards Paul in bed, "had been minded, in her cradle, by her departed mother. I couldn't say how, nor I couldn't say when, nor I couldn't say whether the dear child knew it or not, but Betsy Jane had been watched by her mother, Miss Barry." And Mrs. Wickham, with a very white face, and with watery eyes, and with a tremulous voice, again looked fearfully round the room, and towards Paul in bed. "Nonsense!" cried Miss Barry, somewhat resentful of the idea. "You may say nonsense. I ain't offended, miss. I hope you may be able to think in your own conscience that it is nonsense. You'll find your spirits all the better for it in this. You'll excuse my being so free in this burying ground of a place, which is wearing of me down. Master Paul's a little restless in his sleep. Pat his back, if you please." "Of course you think," said Barry, gently doing what she was asked, "that he has been nursed by his mother too?" "Betsy Jane," returned Mrs. Wickham in her most solemn tones, "was put upon as that child has been put upon, and changed as that child has changed. I have seen her sit, often and often, thinking, like him. I have seen her look, often and often, old, like him. I have heard her, many a time, talk just like him. I consider that child and Betsy Jane on the same footing entirely, Miss Barry." "Is your uncle's child alive?" asked Barry. "Yes, miss, she is alive," returned Mrs. Wickham with an air of triumph, for it was evident. Miss Berry expected the reverse, and is married to a silver chaser. Oh yes, miss, she is alive, apostrophe said Mrs. Wickham, laying strong stress on her nominative case. It being clear that somebody was dead, Mrs. Pipchin's niece inquired who it was. I wouldn't wish to make you uneasy, apostrophe returned Mrs. Wickham, pursuing her supper. Don't ask me. Apostrophe, this was the surest way of being asked again. Miss Berry repeated her question, therefore, and after some resistance and reluctance, Mrs. Wickham laid down her knife, and again glancing round the room, and at Paul in bed, replied. She took fancies to people, whimsical fancies, some of them, others, affections that one might expect to see only stronger than common. They all died. Apostrophe, this was so very unexpected and awful to Mrs. Pipchin's niece that she sat upright on the hard edge of the bedstead, breathing short and surveying her informant with looks of undisguised alarm. Mrs. Wickham shook her left forefinger stealthily towards the bed where Florence lay, then turned it upside down and made several emphatic points at the floor, immediately below which was the parlor in which Mrs. Pipchin habitually consumed the toast. Remember my words, Miss Berry, apostrophe said Mrs. Wickham, and be thankful that Master Paul is not too fond of you. I am, that he's not too fond of me, I assure you, though there isn't much to live for, you'll excuse my being so free in this jail of a house. Apostrophe, apostrophe, Miss Berry's emotion might have led to her patting Paul too hard on the back, or might have produced a cessation of that soothing monotony, but he turned in his bed just now, and, presently awaking, sat up in it with his hair hot and wet from the effects of some childish dream, and asked for Florence. She was out of her own bed at the first sound of his voice, and bending over his pillow immediately, sang him to sleep again. Mrs. Wickham, shaking her head, and letting fall several tears, pointed out the little group to Berry, and turned her eyes up to the ceiling. He's asleep now, my dear, apostrophe said Mrs. Wickham after a pause, you'd better go to bed again. Don't you feel cold? Apostrophe, no, nurse, apostrophe said Florence, laughing. Not at all. Apostrophe, ah. Apostrophe, apostrophe sighed Mrs. Wickham, and she shook her head again, expressing to the watchful Berry, we shall be cold enough, some of us, by and by. Apostrophe, apostrophe, Berry took the frugal supper tray, with which Mrs. Wickham had by Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.